Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
You become what you always were. A very big fish.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Underrated, a podcast that covers films that are underrated, underappreciated, and the ones that have just flown under the radar and passed most people by. I am your host, Derek McDuff. And joining me today is my guest co-host from another show we do together, Can I Say Something, is Damien. How's it going, Damien?
Very well. Thank you for having me, sir.
Thank you. Yeah, and just to do a bit of housekeeping at top before we get into the show, people didn't listen to the last couple episodes and wondering why there's a co-host. So Underrated is now going to be kind of a independent show. So Undercast Company is continuing on, and Underrated is continuing on with me here. Ariel, my esteemed former co-host, is still going to be running all the Undercast stuff, so keep following all that. Alan, another one of my esteemed co-hosts, is taking a bit of a hiatus, taking a much-deserved break, but I never give myself a break. So I am still here, still recording, and I have dragged along Damien to do it with me. But that being said, you know, since now the show is independent, starting all the new social medias, all the new stuff, we got a new website, underratedmoviepodcast.com. Check that out. That's got all the links to, there's the new Instagram, the new Facebook, and importantly, anyone is interested, the new Patreon. So if you were a patron before, that old Patreon, Undercast Patreon, has been mothballed, and there is a new Patreon, new perks and new benefits for specifically this podcast. You can sign up for as little as a dollar for anyone who is interested in doing that. We're going to have perks like our video series, or my video series, Microdose, is going to live there. And then also going to be starting a new podcast specifically for patrons. If you're a patron at least $3 a month, you get the access to, it's going to be launching on October 15th. It's called Underdogs, and once a month we're going to be taking a look at just a sports film. Not necessarily an underrated sports film, but every month we're going to be looking at a different sports film. The poll for the first film we're going to be covering is up right now, so go ahead and vote. The poll is going till October. It's between a bunch of different baseball movies, since, you know, we'll be launching right at MLB playoffs. So if you want to hear me talk about some baseball movies, I'm very excited for that episode. I'm going to be talking with Craig from the Hooks and Runs podcast, is going to be the first guest for that new Underdogs podcast that I'm going to be doing. If you want to choose what we're going to talk about, go ahead and sign up right now. Like I said, for as little as a dollar a month to vote in that Patreon poll, patreon.com/underratedmoviepodcast. But that takes care of all the boring stuff, all the housekeeping up top. Damien, how you doing, man?
Very good. How are you doing?
Good. I am refreshed. By the time people hear this, I will have just gotten back from a cruise, but I am getting ready to go on a cruise right now. Nice. That's the way podcasting works. I'm getting ahead of the game. Recording a few episodes here. Yes. Getting all my ducks in a row with the new podcast, the new format and layout for the podcast. But I am doing well.
That's good. Good to hear.
So Damien, I don't know. Have we?
Yes.
So I guess we should introduce the film we're covering.
Probably should. Yeah.
At this point, we're like 10 minutes in or something. But the movie we're covering is 2003's Big Fish, directed by Tim Burton, starring Ewan McGregor, Albert Finney, Billy Crudup, Jessica Lange, Helena Bonham Carter, and a number of other talented character actors. Yes. The weirdos that are usually in the Tim Burton movies. You know, you got your Dana DeVito's and you know, of course, your what's his name? Did I say Billy Crudup? I might have forgot, skipped over
yes,
Billy Crudup.
I believe so. I believe okay. so.
Yeah, Buscemi. He's always in it. He's yes. always in these things. But yeah, this is a, you know, this is, I sent you a list of when I yep. asked you to, you know, come on and be the fill-in co-host. I was like, here's some movies that I'm thinking to cover, and I had a list of like 60. And you yes. picked Big Fish. So I've been talking yes. for a while, so I'm going to hand the microphone off to you and tell me right. why you picked Big Fish.
Yeah, it was the one I liked most of all the lists you gave me.
Oh.
So there's that. No, I really liked this movie the first time I saw it. You know, it was one of the few Tim Burton movies I hadn't seen. I have really no interest in a lot of the stuff he did post this movie. I think this is a big inflection point for Mr. Burton. He very much went on to work almost exclusively with Johnny Depp and Helena Bonham Carter and made a bunch of remakes, a bunch of property movies with Johnny Depp, the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. He made the Alice in the Wonderland movie. So it was a very much, this is a movie that you look back on and then you look at the next like 20 years of his career and it's very much nothing like this. So it was a very interesting point in his career. It's post, it's the movie he made right after Planet of the Apes, which is a huge flop. So, you know, I was going into this and sort of, this was one of the ones where sort of like The Game for David Fincher, or there's just a few. It's like Benjamin Button. It's very Benjamin Button-y. It's very, you know, Forrest Gumpy. I like those movies a lot that are about like, it's a, what do they call them? Like a, not a historical remake, but a reimagining of history. I forget what they're called. Fictional history sort of movies where you sort of insert the person into those scenes and situations. And it's very interesting that it feels like a Spielberg movie. And if you know, I think about the production of this movie, it almost was made by Spielberg. He was originally going to thinking about working with like Jack Nicholson was going to be the Albert Finney role. Could very much see somebody like Leonardo DiCaprio being in this, but he would actually go on to be in Catch Me If You Can with the movie that Spielberg would go on to make. But just get back to your original question of like why I picked this. You know, there's a lot of these son and father movies hit me pretty close to home. There's a bunch of them that are like this that are sort of you know, Adam Sandler did one called Click, which is famously incredibly sad. It's one of those movies where it's like that's another one where I can imagine very much that he saw this movie and was like, okay, you know, Tim Burton does these type of movies. I do these type of movies and maybe I can do something along those same lines of being fantastical and have some humor, but also have a lot of heart at the end and be very emotional near the end. So I can imagine very much him, Adam Sandler going, looking at this movie and be like, I could do my own version of this. And so, you know, just movies like this. There was one called About Time. I'm not sure if you've seen. Time travel movie dealt big themes with sons and fathers. So very much spoke to me on that level. And then just it's I think it's perfectly fits within the parameters of what the underrated show is about. It's just it's a movie that I think a lot of people don't even know Tim Burton made. I don't think it stands out as Tim Burton in aesthetics or tone or any of that stuff. So just perfectly fit within my wheelhouse and also the wheelhouse of the show.
Yeah, I agree with basically everything you just said. It's probably my favorite Burton movie. Do you think this is the last good Tim Burton movie?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I can't give a fair assessment. I haven't seen any of those what's his name?
Johnny Depp.
Johnny Depp movies that he did. I really have no interest in seeing those, so I couldn't tell you with a straight face whether or not this is as good or worse than or better than any of those. I have to imagine they are, you know, just in the face of them. But yeah, another reason I picked this is Tim Burton is, let me pull up the notes here. Tim Burton is like one of two guys that I grew up just knowing that he made movies. Like as you're a kid, you grow up and you watch things like Back to the Future. You don't know Zemeckis. You watch Men in Black. You don't know Barry Sonnenfeld. I watched those movies on repeat. Jaws, I watched, so I knew Spielberg, obviously. So the two directors that I remember as a kid being like, I like that person, I like that person, was Spielberg and Tim Burton. You know, I watched Batman Returns over and over and over again. Edward Scissorhands, I watched those movies over and over again. So Tim Burton is in this rarefied air for me as somebody that I could identify as a child as having a very, very specific style and aesthetic that I could latch onto and be like, I like those movies because of the way they look and because of the feel of them. So, what was your question?
Is this the last good Tim Burton movie?
Probably in my mind, this was where I just mentioned all that because this is where I fell off. You know, in the 90s, it was right before this, it was, you know, Mars Attacks. I still haven't seen Ed Wood, but of the movies that I enjoyed as a kid, leading up to this movie, that probably would be fair to say, like, this is the movie that I didn't know as a kid. I was like 17, 18 when this movie came out. So yeah, to answer your question, it's probably the last good Burton, just in terms of things that I would go see because it was him. Like, I've seen all the other ones because it was him. And then after this, I'm like, okay, I understand that's Tim Burton, but that's really not what I grew up watching.
Yeah, and I think this one really plays into what you were saying. It's like, this doesn't, you know, he's still weird and it's still fantasy and it's still got all the quirkiness that you would expect of a Tim Burton movie, but it doesn't feel like the Tim Burton product that we've all come to know and expect and see at Hot Topic.
Yeah.
Where it's like, ooh, it's all spirals, staircases, and black and white and, you know, all that stuff. And it felt like Burton, he's really become like, oh, this is what the people expect from me. This is what's going to make a lot of money. So I'm just going to throw Johnny Depp in some white makeup and, you know, because that's what I did with Edward Scissorhands. So that's all I'm going to do for the rest of my career now. This one is it's like I said, it's still got, like, he's not going to like just make a like straight lace movie. Nobody wants to see that from a Tim Burton one. But with this, he injected such color and heart to it, like literal color. Like, this movie is bright and beautiful in a way that pretty much, even like Alice in Wonderland, which is it's colorful, but it's like washed out, drab kind of like colors. Whereas this is like, you know, especially in those scenes shot in the past, so vivid. You know, when he that scene where he's looking out. Or he's standing in the sea of daffodils that he got from every five states or whatever. It's so great, and he just shoots. He shoots those he shoots the present day, quote unquote, the real scenes in just a kind of a flat, normal, quote unquote, boring kind of way. But then when he shoots these past scenes, he's got that little Burton edge, and that really helps, I think, the movie, because it's like, this, it's still a reality, but it's a heightened reality. It's these tall tales that this guy's dad is telling him. And even like the lenses he uses, you can tell are make things very soft. There's a real glow to everything. Particularly, I think that is most notable when he goes to Spectre. That when he's in Spectre, that whole town looks like it is, you know, it's like when you come out of the pool that you've been swimming in too long, your eyes have been like got chlorine in it, and everything's kind of fuzzy. That's how that felt. So I absolutely love the way this is shot. It feels like Tim Burton isn't beholden to the thing that he would be beholden to so often, whether it's himself or studio pressures or whatever. He just wanted to make a good movie. And I think maybe the only time he has done that since is probably Big Eyes, which didn't necessarily work for me, but at least it wasn't like, oh, it's just Burton being Burton again. So maybe every 10 years. So like, he's due for one in like, you know, this year, or next year. But to your point about the dad thing, that is one thing that really makes me love this movie beyond just the artifice of it. Like, it is such a personal story of like this guy and his father. And, you know, that resonated with me quite a bit. Like, I don't have like a strained relationship with my dad or anything like this movie, but there are a lot of similarities between the way that this guy interacts with his dad and the way that I interact with my dad. And there's a line in this that always hits me so hard where the Albert Finney character says, he's like, we're both storytellers. I speak mine out, you write yours down. Like, that is me and my dad to a T. Him as Edward Bloom, my dad Oh, he loves telling these ridiculous stories. And we can always tell that they're like, there's hints, there's grains of truth in them. But he tells these stories about being a kid or being like a young man. And he's like, you know, and he's like, let me tell you about the time I shot an arrow into a tree. I climbed up the tree. I walked across the blast. I fell 15 stories. I was cut up to size. And you know, it's the same exact stuff that, you know, this guy does where he tells these tall tales. And then, you know, just like the younger Bloom, Billy Crudup's character, Will, you know, I'm also a writer. You know, who's like, oh my gosh, like I love to write my stories down. So we have that same relationship. And then, you know, too, my dad has had some health problems over the years. He had a stroke back when I was a teenager. And so, you know, all of that feels so, so right. And I actually, you know, this time rewatching it for the podcast, I watched it with my roommate and he was talking and he was just like, oh, he was like, I was trying not to get choked up. And I think he was trying not to get choked up in front of me because he was like, his dad too was like one of these storytellers. So it's this really great story about the complicated relationships we have with our family and the way that, and just of the nature of storytelling itself and of memory itself, because you have these stories, these memories. And when you go back and you tell them, some things get embellished, some things get changed, some things get left out, and then they become these big things. And some people, like Edward Bloom, like Richard McDuff, will just kind of blow up these stories. So I don't know if, like, you know, you mentioned your dad. Did you have, like, is your dad, is dad lore is the deepest lore, am I right?
It kind of is. Yeah, it's like you can't get anything more personal and more prophetic and more universal than dad stories. You know, the Field of Dreams is one of those where you just go back and you're like, oh God, Jesus Christ. The last scene of him just be like, hey dad, you won't have a catch. It's just crushes, I think, people in general. But yeah, it's, and then to this, the point of being a storyteller, my dad was a storyteller, and he was in a way, he had a comic strip in the North Adams Gazette or whatever it was, newspaper. So he was definitely, he had a creative personality, creative bone in him. He was in a band for a little bit when he was like in the late 50s, early 60s. I'm trying to think. I think he did a bunch of other stuff that was like very, very creative. So I definitely got that from him. But yeah, you know, the whole thing about Billy Crudup in this movie, which we were talking about before, I listened to the Blank Check discussion of this, and they really tore him a new one. They didn't like him at all. They thought he was way too over the top with his negativity. Yeah. And I thought it was fine in this. I thought it was a very interesting juxtaposition, and sort of you flip the your sympathy usually lies with the antagonist or the protagonist in this, and Billy Crudup is supposed to be that for the audience, and he is very much the stick in the mud guy that you would normally see with a father figure, but it's the son in this one. And it's just this idea of like he didn't know he's so mad because his father didn't tell him who he really was, and he got all these stories about him. And I do think it goes back to this thing I always talk about with like Station 11, where the quote is, you know, survival is insufficient. Like you can put a roof over your head, you can put food on the table, but at the end of the day, you got to have something more. You got to have like stories being told, and you got to have, you know, tall tales, and you got to have people entertaining themselves. It can't just be eating and sleeping and working. There has to be more to life than that. And I think his father was very much interested in that. Like how much of it was true, it really doesn't matter. To me, it doesn't matter. I think that was the point of the movie, and having the son be like, well, yeah, I heard all these stories over and over again. It's just like, come on, dad, you can tell me a real thing about you. And I had the discussion with my dad when I was younger, and he was telling me stories about when he was in, I don't think he went to war. Like, he was a bit too young for World War II and too old for Vietnam. So, but he did go to Paris Island. He would tell me stories about that. And he would tell me stories about, you know, growing up when he was a kid. And so I was very much interested in hearing that stuff, no matter if it was true or not. And I think that's really what the movie gets at the end of, like, the point is that he wanted to spend time with his son, and he wanted to do it no matter how he did it, you know? So I think that was really what they were getting at.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you know, it's just, you know, it's this, it's the love language, there's the five love languages, and there's that one love language that is words of affirmation. I think it's what it's called. Yep. And, you know, that's clearly that the love language that these guys have for each other. And you can also, you know, you're absolutely like, right. Like he, you know, he wants to see things, but you know, his dad is also very stubborn. He is, you know, it's funny. You, just like my dad, he's just like this Alabama guy who he's like, this is the way it is. You know, like this is the way, you know, and he, you know, like you mentioned, he is creative. He is somebody who, my dad was also in a band, Edward Bloom. Like he's this clearly guy with all these big dreams and ambitions and stuff like that, but he puts it all aside for his family and he puts his family first. And even though he's going on all these big adventures and he can't always be there with him, he, you know, he really puts his creative stuff aside so that he can do this. And there's even things about him that are good, quote unquote good, that he hides from his family just because they don't fit in with that whole mythology. It's not the side of himself that he wants to present. Like when he goes back and saves Spectre, and his son just assumes like, oh, he's been having this affair and stuff like that. And I love that section of the movie too, because you know, the first whatever 3/4 of the movie, you get it's a really interesting kind of way they utilize these flashbacks is through the literal stories that Bloom Sr. is telling. He's like, you know, start with Albert Finney being like, oh, well, let me tell you about the time I did this. And then you'll cut to Ewan McGregor and it'll be all this stuff. And then, you know, you have that same format done at the end, but it's with the Helena Bonham Carter thing. And it's kind of like filling in all the gaps for the audience, but also for Will. You know, it starts out with him, you know, finding that Chekhov key, that key to the town that he lost in the beginning, and filling in all these like, oh, what happened with Spectre, what happened with all this stuff. It kind of paves over and fills in everything you would want to know. And it's interesting because it is, you know, it's like her telling his style of story. And I love the bookends of that, in that she becomes the witch at the end. You know, she, even though she, you know, and he says like, that doesn't make any sense logically. And she's like, well, you know, if you think like your father, it's totally logical because there's just your mom and there's every other woman. And, you know, like dad stories aren't logical all the time, you know, this all dad lore, you know, and that kind of that's kind of like showing ahead of time that, you know, the ultimate goal of the movie of that, you know, once even though he has passed on, these stories that he told will live on years beyond him. It's already started before he's even passed on, when there's Helena Bonham Carter is telling these stories of how he came and saved the town. And then you see it after his death when, you know, his grandkid is swimming in the pool and they're telling a story about the guy who was like 15 feet tall or whatever. And in reality, he's probably like, you know, like 8 feet tall. But I love that, because I really, really love that funeral scene, because you're like, oh, here's the real versions of everything. It's nice to have that. You're like, oh, they're identical twins. They're not conjoined. Oh, he's an 8 foot guy, not a 7 foot guy. And that's nice to have too. It's like how Will says, when the doctor tells him this actual story of his birth, he's been told the fantastical version so many times, which is clearly the better story. But Will's like, it was nice to get the real version. It is nice to get a little bit of a balance and to understand the reality sometimes behind these fantastic stories, and to have some flavor of each, you know?
Yes, exactly. What did you think of, you know, Hugh McGregor in this movie in general? Because they were talking about this on Blank Check, about his accent was interesting. You know, he's obviously this, is he Irish or is he Scottish, right?
He's Scottish,
Scottish. So interesting putting on not just an American accent, but also like a Southern accent. How did that work for you?
I thought he was good. And, you know, I thought his accent was really spot on. You know, he sounds, you know, like I said, my dad's from Alabama. And he moved when he was young, but like I knew other family members and stuff from Alabama, like my grandma Kitty was from Alabama. And, you know, he sounded convincing to my ear, to the point where, like, you know, I didn't even know until I remember seeing The Island when I was like, you know, 2006 or something. Yeah. And Ewan McGregor does the main character. And then he does, like, spoiler alert for The Island, but you see, like, the version that he's been cloned from, he's an actual Scottish person. And that was the first time I'd heard, like, the real Ewan McGregor and him doing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think he's got a very good ear for accents. He's not like a Sean Connery who's like, I'm a Russian, you know, it's just like, oh, okay.
Yeah, he did pretty well as well. I don't know if, you know, Albert Finney was trying to do that as well, but it was much more, you know. he could hide it behind that sort of big gravelly voice that he has there. You know, we mentioned Billy Crudup already was pretty good in this. Obviously, I saw him first in Almost Famous. I thought that was much more of a subdued role for him, but he was very good in this as well. Probably one of the first times, you know, the U.S. saw Marion Cotillard. I thought you did very well in this as well, right?
This is one of her first roles, honestly. This is, you know, what, 7 years before Inception, you know, a lot of people had this is probably, like I said, a lot of people's introductions to her. She's not a huge part, but she is definitely a very important emotional role. You know, she's kind of like the through line to, you know, to these characters, to, you know, it's important to understand her to really understand Will and his kind of journey that he's been on, because, you know, obviously she's going to be the mother to his child, and Billy Crudup is grappling with, you know, my dad, you know, was he a good dad? Like, he provided for me, but was he off cheating? Well, he was telling me all these stories. I don't know if I can believe anything. And now I'm going to have to be a dad. And she's really the rock for him there while he's going through all of this.
Yep, exactly. I always think it's funny to see David Denman in this movie as you know, getting cucked again, just like he was in the Office. Yeah, that's very funny.
Right.
Very recognizable guy in this. Somebody they mentioned on Blank Check was Deep Roy as Mr. Soggy Bottom. he would go on to be one of the Oompa Loompas in his Charlie and Chocolate Factory.
He's
movies.
All of the Oompa Loompas, yeah.
He's all of them, yes. And then I wrote down, because it's like, I think it's very funny that Danny DeVito had, like, with Dumbo, completing the trilogy of playing like some big top performers,
right?
In Tim Burton movies, he was obviously the Penguin in Batman Returns. Mm-hmm. He's the Amos Calloway in this. He's the big top guy in this. And then completes the trilogy in Dumbo in 2020 or 2021, whatever that was.
Yeah, yeah. Did you know that Tim Burton really likes circuses?
Apparently, right? Yeah. Holy shit! Right. but yeah, like this is just a bunch of really great character actors and supporting cast in this. Missy Pyle playing Mildred in this was very good, you know, supporting cast in this. Is that person, she was like, oh, you sort of see her as like, she could be, she really wanted to be with Edward there in the town, but he was like, you know, I gotta leave. Very, very interesting, like, not even a metaphor, but just very on the nose of being like, you can be in a small town, be very comfortable there and have a decent life, but it can very, very much just sort of drag you down and keep you there. You know, I think the taking off his shoes and putting them on the wire there was very, very good, like, sort of analogy of like what a small town can do to you if you just let it keep you there, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, it's like, because he talks about how he first came too early and then he came too late, and it's like, oh, if he would have come at like the right time, you know, quote unquote, the right time, maybe he would have settled down or something like that. But, you know, that's clearly not the destiny that he saw for himself. His destiny was always going to be to end up with Sandra Bloom. You know, that was always his dream. And, you know, obviously we know that some of the stories of him, like, seeing her and time slowing down and working for 3 years without pay at the circus or whatever, they're obviously exaggerated, but we know that they're based in truth, because, you know, there's that thing Billy Crudup just assumes he makes up the whole story about him going missing in action and all that stuff, but he finds that letter and it's like, oh, there's the truth. So there's always crumbs of the truth, and I love that you'd never know where exactly it ends and where it exactly it cuts off.
Yes. And somebody else I also wanted to bring up, because we haven't really mentioned her, but Jessica Lange was fantastic in this.
Yes.
You know, the part where Finney's in the bathtub and she crawls in with him is just so heartbreaking. You know, obviously, I think one of the first times I really saw her in a big role was in the early seasons of American Horror Story. She was really great in a lot of that stuff there. Another thing I wanted to ask you was, is Tim Burton the goth Wes Anderson? Because, like you mentioned, he's very, very whimsical, very, what's that word they use for Wes Anderson? They sort of combine two words into, it's like whimsical and something else. Whimsy, I don't know, what is it? What is like Wes Anderson's thing? It's like whimsical and whimsical. And let me look it up while you answer. is Tim Burton the goth Wes Anderson to you?
You know, I can see that, yeah, like the hipster kids like Wes Anderson, and the kids who are you know, like, oh, yeah, they're like talking about, oh, yeah, did you listen to the Smiths or whatever? And then the people who are like underneath the bleachers, like smoking a cigarette, being like, yeah, football sucks, you know, are like the people who like Tim Burton. And like, especially I think his earlier roles, or his not roles, but his early directorial features, you know, his Edward Scissorhands, even like Mars Attacks, Ed yeah. Wood, Pee-wee, they feel very personal. I think once he starts, like, in Batman was like a franchise movie, but it felt like a, you know, that was before superheroes films are what they are now.
Yeah.
And he obviously got kicked off of Batman Forever for not being, you know, enough of a studio guy.
yeah.
But I think he becomes more of a studio guy and less of a Wes Anderson once we start hitting around this point in his career, his Planet of the Apes, him basically launching the never-ending live-action Disney remakes we're getting with Alice in Wonderland, and just how he now just kind of does remakes for things, movies and TV shows and stuff from that people loved in the 60s, and everyone is just angry at him for it. So I think early Tim Burton is, I'd say, but yeah. I don't know about current Tim Burton.
Yeah, true.
Did you find that word?
Yeah, quirksical is quirky quirksical. And whimsical.
Ah, quirksical, okay.
Yeah, is what people call Wes Anderson stuff. So yeah, it definitely has that, you know, an aesthetic, but like tone to it of being like very quirky, especially the, like you said, the early stuff. Yeah, very. I could very much, you know, you can sort of, not a one-to-one comparison, but, and Tim Burton didn't direct it, but, you know, I think he wrote the short story to Nightmare Before Christmas. You know, that could be his, like, what's the Mr. Anderson? The stop motion movie that
Fantastic
made.
Mr. Fox. Yeah, yeah. He still wrote it. He gets more credit for it than he deserves, to the point where the other day somebody told me that they love Coraline and they love all Tim Burton things, and I was like, God damn it. I'm so mad. Well, I was wearing a Coraline shirt.
You put your finger up. Well, actually.
Yeah, actually. I was like, I have to say something. I can't.
Yes. And then, you know, just the whole Ewan McGregor thing. I think he, this is around the same time of Moulin Rouge. This is after Attack of the Clones, before Revenge of the Sith. So you have this, you know, Ewan McGregor, you know, very large eyed, that just Cheshire Cat grin, again, referring to Alice in Wonderland. He does that thing very well. You know, this is definitely kicks off that, that era of Ewan. For his career, right?
Yeah, and I think like choosing Ewan was a really good choice, because I think he is really good at taking an older actor's affectations and kind of being like, here's what the young version looked like. Sort of like, I remember years back watching some bonus feature, and it's talking about that scene where they're you see them like him casting off and trying to catch that fish, and you see first Albert Finney, and then it kind of cuts to Ewan McGregor, and like. Finney was like, I was just going to do what I was going to do. He'd have to copy me. And, you know, that's very reminiscent of, like, if you go back and, like, listen to, you know, watch, like, Alec Guinness speak, and then, you know, you're like, hello there. And then you hear, like, Ewan McGregor doing, like, hello there. It's like, he's clearly doing it's not like a impression of this guy, but it feels right. Like, yeah, this is what this guy would have been like when he was younger. And he does, I think, a very, very good job with it.
Yes, exactly. And I did just want to mention, you know, the thing about the storytelling in this and how it's sort of, you know, heightened reality. You know, I think it's the thing a lot of people do. A lot of boomers did it. I think, you know, we blame boomers for that mentality, but I think the Silent Generation did that before them too as well. Of just telling these not even tall tales to them, but because it was reality to them of being like the good old days. Of like, you know, small town America, you could buy a house, you could buy a car. Those things are definitely true. But then it's like you go back and you look at any sort of documentation, you look at documentaries, you look at like stories told about people that were being oppressed at that time. And it's very much not what a lot of people actually remember. You know, I think the firsthand accounts of anything, eyewitness reports, can be are one of the most unreliable ways of telling about an account of anything. So it's a very good representation of somebody telling not just like tall tales or telling lies or telling, you know, their interpretation of a thing, but I think it's a very good allegory for, you know, older people looking back on their life and the world that they remember and the way they remember it and being like, yeah, it was, everything was great and it was big and it was grand. There were like, you look at all the stories he tells and there's really no like major conflicts in any of them that he didn't, couldn't overcome very easily. And you go back and look at time periods that they're talking about. There was so much going on that you could look at and say, hey, actually, no, there was major problems that you're very much overlooking on purpose. So I think it does, you could look at it from that perspective and say, you know, it's a very good representation of how people talk about, you know, their younger days or their better days or the good old days and how it's just full of malarkey, as our president says.
Exactly. And yeah, I think, you know, that kind of reminds me of, you know, we've talked a lot about the Burtonisms of this, of which there are many. It's got the quirks and the circuses and the Helena Bonham Carters that you would need in a Burton movie. But Burton movies are all usually about a kind of family of weirdos. And these people, they're more normal, I would say, than a lot of Burton people, a lot of Burton families. No one has scissors for hands or dresses up like a bat or anything.
Yeah.
But, and I think that a big part of the, like a big thing about this movie that, and it's a thing that, you know, we're maybe talking about now, and I've tried to highlight it, especially in recent episodes, is the screenplay of this movie.
Yeah.
You know, it's something we talked about just like, ironically, Burton is the one screenwriter who gets credit for stuff when, his Night Before Christmas, and then Selleck doesn't get the credit. But John August's script in this is so deeply personal and interesting, and apparently he had read the manuscript for the novel Big Fish, which is by Daniel Wallace, before it was even published. Yes. And John August's father, who was, you know, a storyteller, had just passed away not too long before that. So John August gets Columbia to get the film rights. And then, you know, you talk about it could have been a Spielberg thing, but it would have been a much different movie, clearly, if Spielberg had done it. But I think that just really goes to show you that the emotional core of this movie comes from its screenplay, and it comes on all those core themes about fathers and sons and memory and storytelling really are in that initial screenplay, initial egg of a thing that John August did.
Yeah, exactly. They were, you know, talking about this on Blank Check, and it's very interesting, you know, that the movie that Spielberg does before this is Minority Report, sort of a very, one of his darkest movies, I would say. Mm-hmm. And then Tim Burton does this. So it's very interesting that they sort of switch places for this one movie.
Yeah.
And and you know, Tim Burton, I can imagine him making this movie and then going to the studio or going to like the Academy Awards and not getting nominated for this. And him, this seems like one of those movies or one of those projects that a lot of actors and writers take on, you know, like, you know, they're hoping that the Academy and hoping that the public and hoping that just people in general will take them more seriously, because obviously before this he had a very specific style and was very, made a lot of genre movies and made big budget movies and made his weird little projects. And I think this was probably something that he hoped people would take him seriously. And I'm wondering if, like we were talked about before, of him just sort of diving into a lot of studio movies after this, and I'm wondering if, because of the lack of award even nominations and especially winning ones, do you think this put him on a path and be like, all right, well, fuck it, I'm just gonna make big budget or studio movies after this, I'm not gonna try to be genuine again, I'm not gonna try to make quote unquote adult movies after this again?
You know, you have a point. I think it might have been a stronger point if he hadn't just, you know, had a big studio movie fail right before this,
yeah,
The Planet of the Apes. Because this movie, and it's why I think this was a very, and it's one I've had on the list since I started doing Underrated, and I'm glad you chose it, because this feels, like you're alluding to at the start, very tailor-made for being like, what's an underrated movie? Because this isn't a movie that, like, people don't, like, hate Big Fish or something. It's not like a movie that did terribly the box office or like got bad reviews or anything like that, but it kind of just was a soft failure. Like it was lukewarm in almost every regard. Like you said, didn't really get any awards recognition. It has a 75 Rotten Tomatoes score, which is fresh. It's good, but it's not like, oh, 75, you know. Got a B-plus cinema score, which means, you know, audiences, that's not great. It's not bad, it's not great. And then if you look at the box office, It probably about broke even.
Made $122 million on a $70 million budget. So
yeah, did pretty which means that's actually not good. Like that probably means they broke, once you factor in like marketing and stuff like that, it probably broke about even. Maybe made a small profit, but really nothing to write home about. And that would be a movie where you're like, okay, well, if it didn't lose money at the box office, then maybe you could recoup some of that with like home video and stuff like that. But this movie really hasn't even had a huge cultural impact. You know, it's not become like a cult classic, which when you look at it, it seems like it, this kind of like would be a tailor-made cult classic. It's got all that kind of weirdness, and it's got that heart and that quirk that you would expect to see from a cult classic, especially of the early 2000s. But you know, it never really stuck around, and it's not one that a lot of people have seen. A lot of people haven't even heard of it. So it was a very just extremely lukewarm across the board.
Yeah, unfortunately it was. And yeah, it's probably what is one of those movies that Tim Burton wanted to be a big hit for him. You know, finally wanted him to take seriously. I think this was, you know, this is almost 20 years after he started working in the industry. When his, you know, his first movie was probably in the early 80s. So he's probably thinking, you know, I've made a bunch of stuff that I wanted to make. I've made one studio movie that didn't do well. Let me just make somewhere in the middle, something that will satisfy my own creative outlets, but satisfy sort of the Academy. And it's a very dramatic movie. It's about father and son. And it's also got the weird stuff in there. So I think it very much probably feels like his magnum opus, his thing that he's been building towards for his whole life. Like you said, he lost his father in 2000, lost his mother in 2002. So it was a very personal project for him. And so I can very much imagine it being something like where it landed and it didn't land very well. And he felt very frustrated after the fact.
Yeah. And, you know, to your point, his next film was, you know, was one of his, you know, most kind of like studio sellout shill movies with just Johnny Depp right at the center of it. Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, you know, an adaptation of like Big Fish is obviously based on a book, but it's not a well-known book. This is based on a book that already had one very popular adaptation. And Charlie and the Chocolate Factory to that point, I think was probably his biggest success. It made almost $500 million. It just huge. I think it's also his worst movie. I really, really dislike that movie. But I think that Big Fish having a kind of, you know, doing what it did, all that stuff we talked about, and then Charlie and the Chocolate Factory really hitting big, kind of destroyed Tim Burton the as an artist, you know?
True. Yeah, very true. Yep. Unfortunately.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's maybe an alternate world where, you know, this is more of a hit. This is more beloved. You know, people take it a little more seriously. And, you know, maybe we get Tim Burton more. Maybe he doesn't have to wait 10 years before he makes something personal, because I think his next personal movie, Big Eyes, you know, that's another story about a weird artist who likes to draw things with big eyes. And it's just this interesting story. So if he got to succeed in doing these deep personal things, maybe he would get to keep doing that Wes Anderson thing, you know?
Yes. It's one of those things you think about, like the what could have happened, the road that he could have gone down had this been more of a success. I don't know. And, you know, think about it. It's like, you know, did it really, was it going to be a success as much as it, more than it could have been? It's not really. I mean, it's like you said, it's a kind of a small movie, kind of a, it's got some stars in it, but not really. Ewan McGregor's not as big as he was go on to be. Marion Cotillard wasn't as big as, so not big stars that would draw in a lot of people. So, I mean, just thinking back on the sort of context of it, you know, it sort of doesn't make sense that it didn't really have the success that he thought it might have with those people in it at that time, you know?
Yeah, definitely. It really felt like, you know, it's, and even Billy Crudup hadn't even been Dr. Manhattan yet. People didn't, said he'd been in Almost Famous, but nobody knew who this guy was, you know?
Exactly.
I want to shift gears a little bit, because want to talk about the ending of the film a little bit. Because we talked about how these stories that you tell get passed along, and it is a lot about it's not about how you these things necessarily went, but how your memory of them is, how you pass that along, how you choose to live your life based on these things and how you treat other people around you. And, you know, for years, he's always been like, oh, there's this. I know how I'm going to die. I know how this I'm going to die, which he says with the completely like he's convinced himself of, you know, in the same way that my dad can convince himself of anything. And, yes. You know, and but then he gives it when he says you never the credits looking, he's like, you never told me that story. How does it end? Or like, and then he lets Will tell the story, and he tells this like, it's just, you know, it's simple. It's not like, you know, crazy or anything, but he tells this story about the two of them being together, him turning into the fish at the end, the thing he always was, the big fish. Like, thematically, he brings that back, and you get to, I love in movies when it's bookended by, like, oh, you get to see all these great characters that have you'd come over the course of the movie, and they all come back at the end, and they're all just there wishing him well. And I'm, you know, I'm crying when that scene's happening. How do you feel about the ending of this movie?
How did the ending hit me? Yeah, I think I mentioned this on the show before. My dad passed in 2016, and so anything I've seen after that has really been just heart wrenching. Like I said, I watched About Time, and I watched this in 2016, tried to watch a movie a day then. That was my first attempt to do it, which I did in 2020. But yeah, I tried to do that then, didn't quite make it. So yeah, the ending is just like crushing. Anything like that, anything to do with dads, definitely crushes me. Like I said, Field of Dreams definitely gets to me. So yeah, that whole thing of him just being like, you know, what does it mean that he's, you know, transforms into the big fish at the end, and was it all real and whatever? That's the sort of thing you sort of get at when you sort of meet the people that your dad talked about when he's telling the stories. And I don't know what it means that he transformed into a fish at the end, and was it real? Probably not, but like, you know, sort of bringing him back to where he started and putting him in the water was sort of like him saying, you know, this is where I've meant to be. I've meant to be this fantastical creature, fantastical thing in the world. Like, he's not really meant for this world, and he sort of like wants to be a fantastical creature and things like that. So, you know, it's definitely very, very allegorical in that sense. So and then meeting all those people at the end was sort of closure, I think. I think we could say, is that what that is? And him meeting all those people and being like, oh, okay, so I didn't, he like at a certain point, he's like, tell me who you really are. Stop telling me these tall tales and these fantastical tales. I want to know who you really were. And then comes to the funeral, and all these people actually showed up, and he's like, oh, he was telling me who he was, and I just didn't believe him, you know, that sort of thing. Where I think a lot of times people, I've heard this phrase before, when people tell you who they are, believe them, you know. So it's very much that, where he was, Will was shutting himself off from his dad telling him, and he's like, every time he talked to him, every time they had a conversation in this movie, he's like, dad, just tell me, let's talk. And he's like, we are, this is what we're doing, man. Boy, listen, I'm telling you, you're thinking I'm just making all this stuff up, and maybe I am, but I'm just embellishing some things that happened in my life. And like you said at the beginning, like, it's a love language of telling people about who you are. Maybe you're using, you know, heightened words, heightened language. But if somebody's doing that, don't say that. Don't be like, discredit their feelings. Don't invalidate their feelings. Maybe be like, hold on, just cut out all the bullshit. Tell me what actually happened. I can't, you know, visualize what you're telling me. I can't interpret what you're telling me into allegorical things. Just tell me straight up what happened. And it's like, no, let the person tell you how they're feeling in their own words, if that's the way they feel comfortable doing it, you know?
Yeah, exactly. You know, like, it's just, you know, to bring it back to my own dad again, him telling stories about, like, Monkey Man, you know, like, when he would be, we were in the Grove of Anaheim, and I'd be there with your brother Keith, and you know, I would tell him about Monkey Man, you know, and I would throw an orange, and I'd see dog tracks, and be like, there's the Monkey Man, you know, he's got all these stories, you know, and you know, we talked about the allegory, and how the fish is very allegorical, and you know, it's like something we wonder, like, was there a fish? Was there ever a fish? It's probably not. Like, even when he's like telling the story, like, he was off being a traveling salesman when he allegedly caught that fish. And the thing is, like, yeah, the fish is the stories. Like, you know, f- fishtails is like such a thing, you know, like fishtails is like you make up like these big, oh, the fish was this big, you know. Yeah. And for him, for Edward Bloom, the fish is really allegorical for all of these tall tales he's been telling his whole life. And the most, and the fish is the, him catching the fish is, and getting this story is, it ties to the things that are most important in his life. It's his way of putting the things that are most important in his life into a story. And that would be his wife, his great destiny, and how he has the, he catches it with the ring, and the fish is, you know, as he calls it, a lady fish. And then it's also a pregnant fish, and you know, his son is being born that same day, and how he need, it's happening on that day. It's so significant. And then when Will takes him back to the water, and you know, in the story, and he puts him in the water, and he turns in the fish, and he says, "You become what you always are. Or you become the fish." He becomes the story, as he reiterates later. When he turns into the allegory, this manifestation of these stories that has he has been telling, and that he, even though he is no longer alive as he was, he is now alive as the fish, and as that fish, he is alive as the stories, and he continues to swim on and to live on through these stories that get passed on literally to the next generation. And I think that is such great, and I wish I had read the book, and I don't know if that's in the book, but it feels like perfect for a film to be like, here's some great visual storytelling that we are just putting in front of you, and then we are spelling it out. They're really spelling it out, but it doesn't actually feel like they're hitting you over the head with it. And that's why I think this movie, it does, we talked about how it doesn't have wide appeal, but I think the people who have seen it, even people who aren't incredibly literate at film, can understand, at least on an emotional level, why that ending is so important. And then you follow it up directly with the real funeral, and you know, like some, a lot of the funerals, I've been to a few funerals in my life, and it's this weird collection of just melancholy but of happiness, like just you're happy, and everybody around that funeral is just telling all these stories, and you're seeing people from different parts of the movie that never knew each other or might have known each other for one scene, and everyone's all talking, they're all telling these stories about how this man impacted their life in such a meaningful way. And it's one of my favorite filming endings ever, if I'm being honest. So that's why I had to I had to bring it up here at the end.
You know? Yeah, no, I think it's a great interpretation. I think they nailed it by saying, like, him becoming the fish is him becoming the story. Like, he was telling stories about his life and about those people at the funeral, and then they turn around and they tell stories about him, and they pass on the stories to Will. And then at the very end, you know, Will's son sort of is telling stories just like his dad did. And so it's very much talking about how, like, you know, someday people are going to tell stories about us, and we're telling stories about things in our life and talking about these movies. And so it's a very, very good way of saying, like, you know, he's going to go on and he's going to live. And the you know, Ed Bloom is going to be kept alive in those stories, just like people are going to tell stories about us when we're gone. So it's a very, you know, cyclical way that we sort of keep people alive in our lives, of telling stories about them. And I think it's a very, very good way of saying, like, he was this big fish, he was this larger than life guy, the way he told stories, but then you can go on and then tell stories about him. So I think, yeah, you're totally right that he becomes the story at the end there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's perfectly said. Unless you have any other thoughts on, I think that on the movie, I think that's, do you have anything else to say before we wrap up here?
I'm trying to think. I don't think so. Yeah, I think we pretty much nailed it. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a good place to put before we play, you know, the Pearl Jam song, which, by the way, that's the song that got me in a Pearl Jam for a while. I was like, damn, that's a good fucking, like, you're so emotional. And then it just hits you with that, and you're like, oh, Eddie, stop.
I like I said, I saw this first in 2016, so a long time after this came out. But yeah, I was into Pearl Jam from Nirvana. Nirvana got me into all the grunge stuff.
Yeah, definitely. Well, yep. You know, Damien, thank you again. Thank you again for coming on and talking.
Thanks for having me.
Big Fish, yes. So you know, when we're not doing this, where can the people hear us?
Hear us? Yeah, we'll be on Can I Say Something? It's my own show that has, you know, pretty unique structure. We sort of, I've talked about this before, but I'm going to copyright it because it is such a unique and singular sort of idea that we're going to watch movies and TV shows and talk about them on microphones. So look out for that. It's called Can I Say Something? Anywhere you get your podcasts. Stitcher, I don't know, Stitcher is shut down. I mentioned that the past week. Not Stitcher. Go to Spotify, go to Apple Podcasts, obviously. Go to anywhere you get your podcast, and that'll be there. Go to my blog, damian-sherman.medium.com. Go to B for Benedetta on my Letterbox to check out my reviews there. And that's about it.
Yeah, I'm like the Andy Richter to your Conan on that show, almost.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
But yeah,
Dan's the bear scratching his balls guy.
There you go, perfect.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Definitely check all that stuff out. Links will be in the description. Like I mentioned at the top, all new stuff for us here at the Underrated Podcast. So underratedpodcast.com has links to all of that. Hopefully gonna get some of the patrons back from the old Patreon. Maybe some new ones too. If you're listening and you want to sign up for the Patreon, go ahead and do that. I'd really appreciate it. Here's where I usually throw to Can I Say Something? But I already got you to do that, so we're all good.
Yes, I did. Yes.
So, yeah. Until next time, I will see you guys all later.
Bye-bye.